Good morning. It is 9:20, Wednesday, September 16th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And just as a heads up to our viewers and listeners, John Green is still so distraught about Paco Lopez's ride in the Kentucky Derby that he had to take this whole week off.
Can't top that. I'll just simply say I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Alan Carrasco, managing editor for the Thoroughbred Daily News. And hey, listen, the Chicago Bears have already exceeded my expectations for 2020.
Wish I could say the same about my team. They exceeded my expectations in the other direction. So it's already a dumpster fire. The TDN Writers Room is presented by Keeneland. If you haven't noticed, the Keeneland September sale is going on right now. Book one wrapped up the other day. Book two starts today, and the sale will run through September 25th. Also, it was announced this week that the Breeders' Cup will be at Keeneland in 2022 to follow up this year's Breeders' Cup World Championships at Keeneland. So congratulations to everybody at Keeneland. That's big news. Best of luck for the rest of the sale. Best of luck to the buyers, the consigners, and the sellers. All right, so it wasn't a huge racing weekend. We come off our Derby Wrap show with a little bit of sour news, and really kind of, you know, it really has broad implications for the whole world, what's going on in California and all over the West Coast right now with the wildfires. It affects us. It affects the racing industry because Santa Anita, which was supposed to open this Friday, had to push back its opening of the fall meet until next Friday, September 25th. You can read a lot about it on the TDN, about the air quality is apparently horrible out there. You can even see it in the pictures. You can see it in the workout videos on XPTV at Santa Anita. It's a really terrible situation. It's not just in California, but it does seem to be very, very close to Santa Anita, very close to the San Gabriel Mountains. It's called the Bobcat Fire. What's going on near them right now? It's burned tens of thousands of acres. There's been a lot of evacuations in the area, and it's just, Santa Anita can't seem to catch a break, man. First with the breakdowns last year, then earlier this year they had a shutdown because of COVID, and then looked like they were going to start back up, and then didn't get to. And now with the wildfires going on, it seems like Santa Anita's a little bit cursed right now. And you know, we feel for the horsemen and the horses out there, because it's a really scary situation. You don't know which way it's going to go. It seemed, you know, when the wind was blowing one way that they'd be able to open racing and training, and then the winds shifted the other way, and now they have to push back racing. They had to cancel training a couple days this week because of poor air quality. Obviously, this is a much bigger story than just Santa Anita, just racing, just California. This is a story about the world basically melting and trying to kick us out for destroying it. And that's another story for another day, but you know, right now we hope that Santa Anita can get racing again. But there's no guarantees. You know, supposedly they're going to open next Friday, but we have no idea what the fire and what the environment's going to look like next week. So fingers crossed for them, but just some general reaction from you guys about what's going on out there.
Yeah. Just one thing to add to what you said, Joe, this also affects Golden Gate Fields as well. They shut down last weekend. We haven't heard about them this weekend, but I would assume they're not going to race. I just want to say, you know, some of the same things you said, but just, you know, add my thoughts on it. And you said something that I think is very pertinent. Poor Santa Anita. What? I mean, talk about a racetrack that just can't get a break. Just like you said, I mean, when is the last time they had uninterrupted racing without some sort of crisis to deal with, maybe sometime in 2018. So, you know, you really have to feel for them. And again, I also agree with you that we don't know where this is going to lead. Would anybody be the least bit surprised if they don't race for several weekends in a row? And then how's that going to affect people's plans for the Breeders' Cup, people training horses? I wonder if we get to the point where, say, you're a guy like Bob Baffert who has horses that you want to give a last prep for the Breeders' Cup, and you're looking at racing them in Southern California. Well, A, you can't work them, or you're having a very difficult time working them. B, you have no idea what the racing schedule is going to be. I wonder if maybe in a week or so we're reading about so-and-so ships east, so-and-so ships out of Southern California to coming to New York or someplace like that, where the things are more stable and you know that you're going to be able to have racing. But yeah, it just, horse racing is about one little tiny, tiny blip in this overall big story, which is really scary. And, you know, let's just hope they get these fires under control fairly soon and things get back to normal. But man, you know, again, we don't like to get into politics in this, but if you don't think there's climate change out there, you're an idiot. Okay. All right.
You know, I don't have much to add. Where I live down here in the southern half of New Jersey, it's pretty heavily forested. And a few years ago, we had some widespread brush fires. And just to step outside, just to take two steps out of the garage, I mean, it literally takes your breath away. So I can't fathom what it must be to have wildfires burning literally all around you. And the pictures are, I mean, they just don't do it justice. I mean, you see fires in the hills. I mean, you know the view from the Santa Anita Grandstand. It's one of the most majestic views in the world. The San Gabriel Mountains in the background, you know, with racetracks right in the foreground. You can't see the mountains. I mean, it's completely obscured. So, God, best wishes for that. I saw a tweet this morning from Shay Leperu, whose mother lives close to one of the fires, I think in Monrovia or something. And her mother's looking at the fire, you know, in front of her, and they've literally set back fires. And so the tweet was, now I know exactly what the phrase fighting fire with fire means. So, just a horrible human situation, you know, and you hope the horses can get in enough training, stay sound enough. And like you said, Bill, you know, there's the chandelier and all those Breeders' Cup preps here on the weekend of the 25th. So, yeah, they're definitely hanging in the balance.
Yeah, and that's going to be an interesting point that Bill brought up about whether or not we're going to see racing next weekend, and then whether or not trainers will think about shipping their horses somewhere else, because we have Keeneland opening up in early October. We have Belmont opening up this Friday. So there will be other options for trainers if the Santa Anita situation doesn't improve. But just for what Bill said about, you know, the kids don't want to get into politics, that's the problem. Like, that, this should not be a political issue. Science is science. And this is a country where it's fashionable not to believe in science, unfortunately. And this is where we end up. And it's not just America that this is happening, but it's extreme in America. You know, just there's an anti-science kind of feeling and political movement in this country. And it has real world effects. And this is what it looks like. And the idea that we've politicized science and politicized climate change instead of rallying and seeing this as something that we can all do something about if we unite, that's where we are. And that's a big problem. And I unfortunately don't see it changing very soon. But I just wanted to give people some background about the fire, because if you're maybe an international listener and you're not following it that closely, I mean, it's basically the entire West Coast of this country is on fire. You know, San Francisco, there's glowing orange skies behind the Golden Gate Bridge. Oregon, I have a friend who's in Oregon right now, and she says the sky is orange or gray with smog every single day. But Santa Anita in particular is being affected by the Bobcat Fire, like I said, and it's burning just north of the track in the Angeles National Forest. And it said, the TDN article about it says, as of Tuesday night, the fire had burned over 41,000 acres and was only 3% contained. So the idea that anybody is confident that this is going to be a better situation next Friday seems a little foolhardy. But it says over 1,000 fire personnel are currently assigned to the fire, and it's burning downhill towards the foothill communities near Arcadia, which is where Santa Anita is. And it says the spread has prompted mandatory evacuations for residents of several communities living along the foothills of the San Gabriel Mountains, which, as Al mentioned, provide the backdrop for Santa Anita. So it's a very dicey situation right now. We don't know where it's going to go. We first of all hope and pray for everybody that's affected, that everybody whose lives is in danger, the firefighters that are fighting this. It's very scary, and it's a very treacherous situation. As Bill and Al said, horse racing is a very small part of it, but you know, we are mainly concerned on this podcast for this moment about getting the horses back to working out and training so people can run their horses at Santa Anita, because it's been just a ridiculously unlucky couple of years here for Santa Anita, and we want everybody to get back to normal, whatever that looks like. So Keeneland September got underway on Sunday. Book one was Sunday and Monday. They had a dark day yesterday. Book two will get underway later today. The sale will go through, as I mentioned, in the open September 25th. We're going to talk to Jeffrey Russell, the head of sales at Keeneland, a little bit later, get his early impressions on the sale and the obviously unusual circumstances of the sale, as everything has unusual circumstances this year. I'm not a sale expert by any means, and Bill is even less of a sale expert. Al is the sale expert we have on this week's show, since John is still crying about Paco Lopez. But some things, just from a layman's perspective, some things that caught my eye. There was 13 different buyers of the 14 seven-figure horses in the first 2 days. So I thought that was pretty interesting. There wasn't really that centralized domination at the top, like an Alfin and a couple other people. But so that's something I noticed. The RNA rate is obviously very high. I think it was over 40%. So that's never good news for a sale or for sellers or consigners. I think that reflects the overall trepidation around the market and people wanting to hold on to their assets to see what happens in the next 6 months or so with COVID and whether or not the economy rebounds. So I think that's a trend that we're going to see a little bit at least. I think it's something we've seen over the summer and into the fall. The other thing I wanted to mention was Tappet, the great return of Tappet. You know, I think that he's obviously been a dominant sire and a very fashionable, you know, perennially leading sire for a long time. But I felt like he kind of was pushed to the back burner a little bit with the emergence of Into Mischief, Uncle Mo, Quality Road to a certain extent, particularly Into Mischief. But Tappet had the top, was responsible for the toppers on Sunday and Monday, and a $2 million horse on Monday. So you could never count Tappet out. You know, those horses always seem to do well at the sales. So I'm going to toss it to Al now and his observations.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a glass half full and a glass half empty approach. I mean, I think it's remarkable, as Jeff Russell said after Monday's session, I think it's remarkable that there's a sale in the first place. There were months of uncertainty and working with federal and state governments and trying to get protocols in place. And I think for a time, you couldn't guarantee there was going to be a September sale, but it is a September sale. It's the world's biggest sale of its kind. And I think Keeneland deserves full marks for getting the sale off and running and on schedule. And it's no negative comment on the other sales companies who had to adjust their calendars, and they did an equally great job, OBS and Faithy Tipton, in creating a marketplace during this time of uncertainty. But Keeneland's gotten the sale off and running. And listen, over the course of 2 days and 12 hours of sales, they sold $88 million in horse flesh, $14 million horses with a $2 million topper, with 13 different buyers, like you said, Joe. So it's always good to see that variety. There was some decent participation from Japanese bidders, mostly online. That's a kind of a new wrinkle this year for Keeneland. A gentleman called Yuji Hasegawa bought a Tappet for $825,000 on the phone or on the internet on Monday. And he bought a Tappet colt last year, actually called Vanishing Point, that won first time out in Japan just a few weeks ago. So, but, you know, taken as a ratio of the horse's catalog between the outs and the buybacks, something like 45% of the catalog changed hands. So on the surface, that's not a number that's going to be encouraging. But I think going forward, and I think Jeff will address this, going forward, there are going to be reasons that that people will adjust, as people always do. These are professionals. They adjust reserves as necessary to get their horses sold. And I think as the sale gets into the later books, I think you'll see those types of horses getting sold. So the RNA rate should come down some, you know, even if statistically right now it's not perfect.
Yeah, I think Al's point is good, that, you know, just the fact that there's a sale, you know, going on in general, and the fact that you did have so many seven-figure horses, you know, even though the RNA rate is too high at the top of the market, it seems, you know, taking out last year's outlier with the $8.2 million yearling, it seems to be pretty consistent with past September sales. You know, in terms of the top of the market. So, you know, kudos to Keeneland and all the sales companies, Facing Tipton, OBS, because they have been thrown curveball after curveball this year. It's so difficult. Racing is a little bit easier to conduct in the COVID world because basically you just kick out the fans, you test everybody, and then you're all good. But you can't kick everybody out of a sale as big as Keeneland September. You can do lesser digital sales, but for Keeneland September, you have to have people in attendance, at least to some capacity. And I'm sure they've gotten pushback from people for, you know, trying to do masks and all these protocols and everything, but you know, they've held firm. They've been firm in their protocols and their safety measures from the beginning. And I think they deserve a lot of credit for that. And so we'll check in next week with the rest of the sales, see if the RNA rate has gone down a little bit. But overall, great thing to be able to have this sale in the first place. Totally agree with that. Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your action and chances for a big horse. Check out why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So Bill had some reporting on this the other day that Betfair, which was the exchange wagering platform that was introduced to New Jersey a couple of years ago, fixed odds wagering, which is super popular in Europe and overseas. It was an experiment to try to get it to catch on in America. Did not work out for several reasons, which we'll get into. So they're gonna fold up their American exchange. I'll toss it to Bill first so he can run down the particulars of the story, and then I have several reactions. I'm sure Al does as well.
Yeah, and if you're not familiar with Betfair, the exchange wagering concept, it's a marketplace where people set odds and then take in bets. And the exchange wagers is exactly what it is. And the reason why this is kind of a big story is because this thing was wildly successful in England, more so in England than other places, but also other countries around the world where it spread. And to the point where, you know, people were wondering if this would actually replace the more traditional forms of betting. They still exist, obviously, in places like England, but the percentage of the marketplace now taken up by Betfair is a huge amount. So now this comes into the United States and you're thinking, okay, why wouldn't this be a big deal here as well? So not only was it not a big deal, it was an abject failure. I mean, they're pulling the plug on it because obviously they're losing money. I mean, it's awful hard to lose money when you're running a online betting platform, but the costs of running it were obviously higher than the amount of money they were taking in. So the plug will be pulled at the end of September. Betfair was only in New Jersey. They obviously had hoped to spread to other states, but when couldn't get off the ground in New Jersey, what other states are even going to want to bother with this when they're handling peanuts every single day? And Joe, like you said, you want to get into some of your thoughts, the reasons why it didn't succeed. And there are a couple, and kind of the big three are, number one, that they didn't have the signals from most of the major tracks, no New York, no California, no Florida, et cetera. Number two is they weren't allowed to expand outside of New Jersey. So that obviously kept the amount of potential customers way down. But the one I think, I bet that you're itching to talk about, because I think it's something that is a subject that we can talk about on not just Betfair, but a lot of different things, was the takeout rate. The takeout rate or the commission on when you made a winning wager in Europe was 5%. So essentially have a 5% takeout. That obviously had a huge amount of why it was so successful. In the US, they didn't try it at 5%, they tried it at 12%. The reason being that they had to provide money to the tracks, purses, et cetera. The whole makeup and the whole system in England is much different. And I got to think, even though 12% is a good deal, it's not 5%. And I got to think that the difference between 5% and 12%, so a higher takeout rate than they had in Europe, was one of the reasons why it failed. Even 12%, which is much better than what you see on takeouts every day at the week of racetrack, is still too much. You can't make money with a 12% takeout unless you're just so much better than everybody else.
I mean, I think that's a big reason. I think the thing you mentioned about not having the signals from the major tracks is a huge deal because, you know, as much as we love Monmouth Park in the Red Bank area, TDN, it's not going to attract the kind of wagering dollar that Saratoga does, especially when they're going up against each other. And then I think Woodbine, maybe Tampa, were the only other tracks that Betfair had that I would be willing to bet. The fact that it was only in New Jersey at first, at least, you know, the pilot program was in New Jersey, I think that was a major restriction as well. But also, I think one of the reasons that it didn't work out is that Americans are very, they're kind of hooked on exotic wagering now. to a greater extent than overseas bettors. And I think it's a little bit difficult to try to wean people off of pick fours, pick fives, trifectas, superfectas, because on its face, Betfair was even with the 12% takeout, I think Betfair was a good value proposition because you were able to set your own odds. And I think that that's something that, you know, Bill talks about this a lot. It can combat the kind of thing where there are these huge odds drops late in races where you bet a winner and you feel like a loser because the horse is half the price as it was when you bet it. And that's Betfair is the kind of thing that can combat that because you get to set your own price. And if the horse doesn't go off at that price, if nobody takes your bet, you don't bet it. So that could have been a huge boon for people who hate those kind of late odds drops. And I think that's the vast majority of horse players hate that. So that was, and also the live in-race betting had a lot of potential as well, because there are so many times where I was just talking to a friend about this the other day. I was trying to explain to him, he's a novice, trying to explain to him pace, where there are a lot of times where I can basically tell who's going to win half mile into the race when it comes to, you know, fast fractions or slow fractions, especially in New York turf races. I can usually tell who's going to win halfway into the race. So that had a lot of potential as well. That runs into problems when it comes to, you know, the lag in video streaming. I feel like I would only feel comfortable doing that if I were live on track watching the race, but there's an appetite for that kind of thing in America, but I don't think, you know, the circumstances surrounding the unveiling of it led to that appetite being met.
Yeah, I never bet a lot of money. So, I mean, I would love the option of anti-post betting at fixed odds, and like you said, Joe, in race, in running, there's just a thrill. But I think number one, I do think that our bettors are kind of set in their ways and trying to unveil some sort of newfangled product is just going to meet with some resistance. And I think that people are increasingly married to trying to hit that home run ball. Number one. And I just wonder too about the technology. Like you said, Joe, you would only be comfortable doing that if you were live on track, but what's to say that the technology is fast enough and real time enough that when you click your bet at the 3/8, that it's not going to go in until the 5/16 or the quarter pole or something, and the entire complexion might have changed by then. So I wonder too if the platform was user ready and up to speed enough to do that. I know Brian DiDonato used to use the exchange a lot and did so successfully, and Brian's a good bettor anyways. It's sad that the idea has gone by the wayside.
Well, I wanted to, Brian would definitely be a good person to have on this week because he was an early adopter of this. But I wanted to ask you, Al, I don't know if you're friendly with a lot of European bettors, mm-hmm. but the in-race betting, is that popular over there? Does that work out?
I think people do it quite often, yeah. I think oftentimes you see tweets come out after a horse that looked hopelessly beaten 300 meters from home. You know, they'll always tweet something like, yeah, he was 67-1 in running and things like that. I think it is something that's popular.
Well, and just overall, I think, you know, the fewer wagering options, the worse off we are as bettors in America and North America. And I think one of the problems that we didn't mention, at least in the beginning, is this really is one of those things that goes back to the lack of uniformity and cooperation in racing, because, you know, there's just so many interests that you have to please in order to get something like this going in America. It's much easier, you know, I don't know this for a fact, but I assume it's much easier in the UK to just strike a deal with the British Horse Racing Authority, and then you can have your product introduced to all the UK tracks. In America, it's just never that simple. There's always so many people you have to work with and grease, and, you know, it's just, it never worked. And that's one of the reasons that they were only able to start in New Jersey and they were only able to get these B-level tracks is, you know, there are so many different interests and so many different entities in racing that you can't really strike a universal deal in America for something like this. And I think it's unfortunate because, you know, it's something that I think remedies a lot of problems in racing and is a much different and much more innovative way of betting the horses. And this is a very antiquated betting game as a general rule, especially in America. So it's unfortunate that it didn't catch on. And I think one of the reasons that it didn't catch on is that America can't get stuff together, you know, in terms of having a unified commission or a unified front to try to improve the sport. It always has to be these fragments, these splinter groups that are trying to do things on their own. And, you know, I give credit to Betfair for trying this, and I wish it had worked out. And, you know, I think the American betting landscape is going to be worse off for it not working out. So Keeneland has been very proactive about the whole COVID situation. They've announced their protocols way in advance. They were the first to cancel sales earlier this year. They canceled the Keeneland April sale, which I thought kind of had a cascading effect across the industry of people, you know, thinking they could have these sales, and eventually they thought better of it. So I think Keeneland's kind of been on the forefront of that. So they have announced that they will have no fans at the fall meet, which is coming up in October, as well as at the Breeders' Cup. I think some owners will be able to be on track, and they'll obviously have, you know, essential personnel as well to conduct the race meet and the Breeders' Cup. You know, it's unfortunate because Keeneland is a big fan centric event. It's like Saratoga. I think, you know, there are some events that rely on fans more than others. I think of the US Open tennis tournament, and that was extremely eerie to see no fans there. And usually there's almost a million people that come through the grounds at the US Open. I'm usually one of them. I try to make it there every year. So that was a little creepy to see those giant, you know, the Billie Jean King Tennis Center with no people at it. It was unfortunate. Keeneland's kind of like that. Keeneland is a big fan experience. So obviously not an easy decision for them, but I think it was the right decision. I think we can all agree on that, as well as the Breeders' Cup. But I just wonder how long this is going to go on, because it wasn't too long ago, maybe a month ago or so, that Churchill had designs on having fans at the Kentucky Derby. And we thought that was a bad idea, but a couple months ago, it was at least in the realm of possibility. And here we are in mid-September and still not safe to have fans at the Breeders' Cup. And, you know, not to beat a dead horse, but, you know, this is what happens in a country where you just can't even agree on something as simple as putting a mask on. And you can't have the nice things unless you do the work to earn them. And it doesn't seem like the cases and deaths are dropping as precipitously as, you know, we would like. You know, you look at countries in Europe, obviously much smaller populations, but even putting all of them combined, there's maybe like 100 deaths a day between all the European countries. And America, we're still pushing 1,000. Like it's honestly kind of gross and really sad that we haven't, I'm going off a tangent here, but we really haven't even had any mourning here in America. We haven't had any days of mourning, or, you know, we had 9/11 in America in 2001, and, you know, we still commemorate it every year, as we should. And here we were pushing 200,000 deaths in America, and we don't even recognize it. We fly the flags at half staff, and that's basically it. We just go on with our lives. Sports are all back now. We have all our distractions. But, you know, I think when these events like the US Open, like Keeneland, like the Breeders' Cup, like the Derby don't have fans, that's the only time where it really, you know, punctures this fog that we're all in, where we've just become used to this mass death. And it's scary, and it says bad things about us and our psyche as Americans. And, you know, I don't know that we're going to have fans at the Pegasus or next year's Derby or whatever the next big race is. I can't guarantee that we're going to have fans there. And it's just, you know, a lot of us, I think, thought that this was going to be over by now, or at least more contained. And, you know, here we are in mid-September, and we still don't have the privileges of having fans at the Breeders' Cup. And I can't say it's going to get better. You know, I read an article this week, and this is obviously, you know, the extreme. Maybe this is alarmist, but that there might not be mass distribution of a vaccine until the end of 2024. So this is the idea that this is just going to go away on its own has proven to be false, and yet people are still hoping for that. And, you know, I think Keeneland's doing the right thing by not having fans at the Breeders' Cup. But it's unfortunate that they're put in that position. It's unfortunate that these businesses and these racetracks are continually put in this position where they have to forego all of this, you know, really crucial revenue just because this country can't get its act together. Any thoughts, guys?
You know, I'm so depressed after hearing you talk. I don't know if I can come up with anything cogent to say.
I depressed myself. I wasn't expecting to go there, but yeah. I mean, here we are.
But you know what, Joe? Unfortunately, I agree with everything you said. I'm not going to counter any of your arguments. I mean, one thing, though, it is, so far as the 2020 Breeders' Cup, I mean, what's in it for Keeneland to run it with no fans? I mean, essentially nothing. I should know this, but I don't know exactly how they divide up the betting between the Breeders' Cup and the host track. But I mean, it's a big nothing burger for Keeneland to have it with no fans. So it was nice of the Breeders' Cup and good. You talk about not a lot of cooperation racing, but here's something where obviously the Breeders' Cup and Keeneland work very well behind the scenes to not only figure out what they're going to do for 2020, but the 2022 Breeders' Cup, which normally would not on the now, I mean, it's evident now that we're only going to have four tracks, perhaps for the rest of the history of mankind, that will host the Breeders' Cup. So they would not have gotten it until 2024. So it was a nice makeup call for them, for Keeneland to give it to them for 2022. And presumably everything should be back to normal. But you know, again, I don't want to, you know, make this even more, downbeat than it is. But, when I remember this all started, like the rest of us, it started in March and we're thinking, okay, you know, by Saratoga, by the summer, certainly by Labor Day, everything will be fine. And here we are. So will the 2021 Derby be run with 150,000 fans in the stands? If you ask me right now, I'd say probably not. As depressing as that is. So when are we going to get back to normal? Someday. But that's all we know. Someday. Let's hope it's not 2024. But I've read some of the same things that you have, Joe, and it is. It is so depressing.
I'm not sure. Do we know how many fans? I know that there were fans at the Thursday night opening game, NFL game in Kansas City. Do you know how many fans were there? And I mean, they were obviously well spaced, but it was 10,000.
I think it was the similar thing that Churchill was trying to do, where it was like 20% of capacity, something. Right. So maybe like 15,000.
Right. So it'd be interesting to hear if anything comes of that. I mean, they seemed spaced out enough where if they followed all the protocols, it wouldn't have mattered. But just one sidebar, sort of the Hong Kong Jockey Club. The South China Morning Post reported yesterday or a couple days ago that they're going to start allowing groups of four with advanced bookings into the racetracks in Hong Kong. So it's always been a marvel to me that Hong Kong, which is like 4 hours from Wuhan, they've had hundreds of deaths, not thousands. And they've been able to continue racing. I mean, mostly without fans, but so that, you know, as a fan of Hong Kong racing, I was obviously pretty happy to hear that. But I guess it can be done, but we're going to have to get a whole lot better at playing by the rules.
Yeah, something we do well in America. Go ahead.
I want to and add something to what Alan said, and I saw what you meant about the NFL game, but it's also very pertinent that I'm reading stories from beforehand, but no reason to believe this number isn't right, that Bashir allows 12,000 fans for Louisville football game. So their opener in a stadium, you know, really right across the street from Churchill Downs, they allowed 12,000 people. Now, I'm not saying it would be a good idea to allow 12,000 people to come to the Breeders' Cup. Frankly, I don't think it would be. But that's, you know, there's a lot of hypocrisies that go on with COVID-19, and this is certainly one of them. I don't know how they can justify allowing 12,000 people at a Louisville football game and allowing other than owners and trainers and essential personnel zero at the Breeders' Cup and Kentucky Derby. So I hope all 12,000 people come home safe from the Louisville football game. But it's certainly something where that not everybody's on the same page when it comes to this.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think college football is such big business in America, and there's so many powerful people who really, really care about college football. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that the president has been pushing to restart again. And I think that puts a lot of pressure on college football commissioners and the people in these who run these states to try to open up college football games. But there's like, what have we done as a country to deserve that? It's basically, we're just like, I want it. I want college football. Give it to me. Like that's where we are. Like we've done none of the work to deserve these things to come back. We want it. And you know, I hate to keep harping on this point, but here in New York, like We did the right things. Even if you walk around now, the positivity rate is under 1%. You walk around my neighborhood, 90% of people are wearing masks. Like, that's, it really is that simple, guys. And still, you can't get more than 50% of the country to do it. It's just, it's the most insane own goal, unforced error thing I've ever seen. But no, I can only do so much by you know, railing about it and yelling at people to wear masks every week. People just, they got to do the right things and we don't do it. But, you know, yeah, I mean, who knows? Like, who knows when we're going to have major fan gatherings at big events. That's an interesting point that Bill brought up about the Louisville football game. That doesn't seem like a good idea, but even that is a small percentage of capacity. When are we going to have a full stadium again? I wouldn't bank on it happening in the next year or so. We'll see. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtv.com. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is Jeffrey Russell, the head of sales operations at Keeneland. Obviously a busy time for him and for Keeneland. Thank you for making time for us, Jeffrey.
Oh, happy to be here, guys.
So it's good to talk to you. This is your first live in-person sale since COVID hit. So I assume you've been preparing for this for a really long time. I assume there's been a lot of challenges to get this thing to go off. Seems so far so good. What are some of the biggest obstacles you guys have had to face?
Well, we feel very fortunate that we are pretty much the only sales company in the world that has conducted the sale on the calendar that we set in January, which we find quite amazing that we've been that fortunate. Once we went down in lockdown in March 16th, I think it was the great day, we've been planning for it, and each plan changed literally monthly. We didn't know what we were allowed to do, what we weren't allowed to do. At one stage, we were told we couldn't use the sales pavilion. Now we're allowed to use it at 40%. So, it has been a moving target all the way along. We joked back in the early part of the pandemic, our Zoom calls internally were called the what if meetings. What if this happens? And what if that happens? And what can we do here? So we feel very fortunate. We talked to our consigners quite a lot through the whole thing and trying to work out what would be best for everybody. And then all the protocols that were set in place by our health officials here, we are following.
Hey, Jeffrey, it's Bill Finley, and thanks for joining us. Why don't we stay on that same sort of subject of sort of what's new and different with this sale? And this is a sale where the internet has become a big part of it. I was just curious, what kind of volume are seen over the internet? How many horses have sold over the internet? And has it been particularly key in getting the foreign buyers to be able to participate in the sale, whereas, of course, they're not allowed to come to the United States because of COVID?
Yeah, I mean, we've had to change, even on campus, we've had to change things because only with the sales pavilion at 40%, we've reduced even the back walking ring participation. So we've actually added another spot back in our show ring. So people have three different areas where they can bid on the campus. Then we've expanded our telephone bidding. And then, like all sales companies, we have now an online internet platform, which in the first 2 days has been proven very popular. We sold 5 horses the first day and I think 4 horses the second. Second day, we sold, most of them are actually sold to Japan. Their 2 highest priced horses both went to Japan. So they had their agents here on the grounds who did the homework, did the vet work, did all that, and let the principal do the bidding himself.
Let's get into the results from Sunday and Monday. You had 14 horses sell for seven figures. We're not going to get into the business of comparing apples to oranges and looking to back at last year. But last year there were a unique set of circumstances. You had a top seller that was a once in a blue moon type of horse. The next 4 were purchased by Godolphin, and Godolphin's been missing from the sheets so far this week. So can you talk about the results from the first 2 days within that context?
Well, I mean, the top of the market has been very strong. Yes, we've had 14 individual horses bring in excess of $1 million. And most interestingly, that they're up to 13 different buyers. And so the buying group has spread out a bit. Last year, we had $22 million horses, but also to 14 individual buying accounts. So the buying numbers of buying the top end are staying the same.
I wanted to ask, there was an announcement last week about Keeneland having an October digital sale. That was a little bit of a surprise. What was the impetus for that? And yeah, so what made you guys jump into that?
Well, we've been working with Horseco all year, and even before the pandemic, we've been looking at the digital sales market. It's very successful and very popular down in Australia. We've been watching and monitoring it down there. And we thought that if we could set up a calendar of sales throughout the year that could complement the live auction, we don't want to take anything away from the live auction because obviously that's our business. But if it could complement it and help people with cash flow, if a horse jumped up and won a race that they could be, didn't want to wait till now, January, because our November sale is closed, it would give them an opportunity to get some cash flow. So we had one in June to launch it. Then we got obviously busy with our September preparations and our November preparations. So we felt that having a sale in October could help the market out with the end of the kind of summer racing and then going into the fall racing, that we might be able to pick up some horses of racing age that need to be moved on.
Hey, Jeffrey, every year we always come up with the exact same subject about what's going to go on with the middle market. And you know the pattern. The higher end horse is very good. The middle market, not so good. I know it's a little bit early to get a total focus on this, but after the first day of the sales, and also considering all the obstacles that COVID has put in place for the sale going forward, what are your projections for the middle market as we get onto the latter books?
I mean, we also have a concern with the middle market, obviously. People buy horses with discretionary income. And currently, with COVID, the discretionary income has gone down. Having said that, we've had pretty good response with new and reestablished credit, apart from the people who already have credit with us. And when I talked to a couple of the consigners about book two yesterday, they said they had new faces that they didn't see for book one. So that's positive too. So we're going to accentuate on positives during the COVID age and keep our fingers crossed as we go through the next four books.
Jeff, back on the buyers, I mean, you had an interesting mix at the top. Larry Best is obviously active. Joe Allen through Robbie Medina had a new buyer at the seven-figure level from a Dan Blacker client, which I thought was interesting. Thinking specifically about these big, powerful partnerships, Eclipse, Lapenta, Gainsway, Winchell, this is not something that we're completely used to in this country. It does happen in places like Australia where big power conglomerates kind of team up and spread their resources. But what's your take on pooling those sorts of resources? Is it a net positive, or what's your thought on that?
Well, I mean, we've seen in over the last couple of years, partnership more like two people in a partnership. I mean, Mr. Tori Alba teamed up with several different people. Mandy has teamed up with several different people, but just one. So this was the first sale we've seen multiple partners on top horses. I mean, it's good because we're getting the horses sold. So, I mean, I look at it that way. And also, I mean, the price of horses has gone up. They like to spread the risk among themselves. So they team up and don't want to compete against each other and have fun racing them together.
I wanted to ask about the COVID protocols that you guys have instated. You've done a very good job, I think, on the racing and the sales side, being proactive about that. You know, in the overall community, I'd say there's mixed responses to wearing masks and all this stuff. But what have you seen as a response from the racing and sales community when you started instating these policies?
I mean, COVID has been a very polarizing situation. I mean, so we are very concerned about this time of year. We have September, we have our October race meet, we have the Breeders' Cup in November, then we have our November breeding stock sale. So it's a very important 3 months for us and for the thoroughbred industry. So we wanted to make sure that we could conduct all of those in the next 3 months. So we worked very diligently with our state government, our local health departments, so we could have something. Yeah, we have pushback from several people about masks, about the fact that we asked for testing on our consigners. But when you explain to them why we wanted them for the safety of everybody, everybody understands it. And while they're not happy about it, they're at least fulfilling our requests.
Hey, Jeffrey, I apologize for asking you a racing question. I know this is supposed to be about sales, but I don't think we should go through this interview and not talk about the Breeders' Cup and the big announcement that came out of Keeneland and the Breeders' Cup this weekend. And I hope you're comfortable speaking for the Keeneland family as a whole. But how big a setback is it to not have fans in the 2020 Breeders' Cup? And how big of a shot in the arm or a good news story is that the Breeders' Cup is coming back to Keeneland as soon as 2022?
Well, I mean, I think all racing jurisdictions, and I will speak as a salesperson and not a racing official, all racing jurisdictions are upset by not having fans. Fans are the core people of our industry. Without them, we don't have an industry. So we like, and Keeneland is a very social racetrack. So we want our fans here. We appreciate our fans here. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when we didn't have Kurt Becker here and listening to the roar of the fans as the race developed. So, I mean, when we had our July meet, it was surreal, to be very honest. So, I mean, we want to get the fans back here as quickly as possible to enjoy Keeneland and also enjoy horse racing. Having said that, I think it's very important for the safety of everybody that we do it in a manageable way. The Breeders' Cup have allowed participants. We're going to allow, again, participants. It's very important, personally, and I'm sure for other people here at Keeneland, that we get the owners back on the racetrack. Yeah, these are people who have the huge financial involvement in this sport. They need to be able to see their horses. They need to see their horses breeze in the morning, and they need to be able to see their horses run. So I'm delighted that we're able to offer that to our owners and our breeders so they can see their horses.
Jeff, after Monday's session, you had a comment about the buyback rate and then even the number of horses that withdrawn. I think both of those numbers were uncomfortably high from the perspective of sales company. But can you explain sort of the mechanics of that? Was that something completely unexpected? And I think you had an explanation for this the other night as well, but what do you see happening going forwards in book 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6?
Well, book 1 is a very unique book in its own sense because it is the top end of the market, and the people who breed at this top end of the market and the breeders here have the ability to put these horses into training or hold them on for another sale. As we go through the sale, that dynamic changes and it becomes a very much a commercial crop. And with a commercial crop, people have to sell. And so we will just have to, we hope that they will have more sales, less outs, and they will continue on.
Jeffrey, thanks so much for the time. We'll let you get back to work now, busy time. But best of luck for the rest of the meet, for the rest of the sale, and the fall meet.
I appreciate it very much, guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeff.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Jeffrey Russell, will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over 4 decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
So we would be remiss if we didn't mention this before we sign off. Yesterday, Pat Smullen, champion Irish jockey, won the Irish Flat Racing Champion Jockey title 9 times. He's a dual classic winner. We wrote a column for the TDN. He wrote a really fun, interesting column for us. And he passed away, unfortunately, at only 43 years old because of pancreatic cancer. It's just a horrible thing. We, our condolences go out to his family. Just really tragic and seemed like a really good guy by everything that I could tell. But I know Al is much more in tune with European racing, so I'll toss it to him.
Yeah, I mean, obviously pancreatic cancer is one of the more deadly forms of cancer, and it's obviously all deadly. But, he was diagnosed in March 2018. Apparently he had some gallstones, went to get them checked out, and then on top of that learned about the pancreatic cancer. So But what a gifted writer he was. I mean, he won the 2016, had the Epsom and Irish Derby double with Harzand, who's now a freshman sire for the Aga Khan. But longtime association with trainer Dermot Weldon. And if you scour Twitter, if you have some time to read the tributes, click on a few videos from the Cartier Awards. He was given a special award. And just to see, I guess the telltale sign of how great he was just to see what his peers had to say about him. Frankie Dettori, John Shockey, A.P. McCoy, every one of them spoke about him with such reverence. And I watched an interview that was aired on the RTE network in Ireland, 7 minutes. One of the greatest interviews I've ever seen. But it happened last year when Smullen organized a charity event, ended up raising £2.5 million for cancer research. And he was one-on-one with the interview, and it was never about Pat Smullen. It was always about trying to help people who might have the same diagnosis or other types of cancer, try to help them or help funding in cancer research. And it was never about Pat Smullen. And certainly other people are much more acquainted with Pat than I am. I assume Emma Barry is going to write something for our paper. She kind of was the liaison for Pat's column in our paper. But a gifted writer. He actually had a few winning rides here in America. He rode the winner of the 2002 Matriarch for Dermot Weld and Moyglair Stud. That was one of his main clients. Rode a filly called Dress to Thrill to win the Matriarch. Beat Golden Apples and Banks Hill and beat fellow jockeys Jerry Bailey and Pat Valenzuela in their prime. Dermot Weld said something on air this morning about just how Pat Smullen flat out rode America's top jockeys in the final half furlong of that race. So a great talent, but by all accounts, a better human being, and it's a sad loss for worldwide horse racing.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a great tribute from you, and I'm like you said, I assume Emma's gonna give him a great tribute as well. We want to send our condolences to all of Pat's friends and everybody that worked with him, also at the TDN. If you want to donate to pancreatic cancer research, there's the Les Garden Foundation, there's the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, there's the MSK Cancer Research. So it's a very, very deadly disease, unfortunately. And Pat was way, way too young to go. 43 years old is just crazy young, and it's a beast, pancreatic cancer. So if you can donate to research or any kind of charity that works with pancreatic cancer research and treatment, that's something that I would recommend you do. And rest in peace to Pat Mullen, and he'll definitely be missed. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Remember, the Keeneland September sale is through September 25th. That'll lead right into the October Fall Meet of Keeneland and then the Breeders' Cup. And Breeders' Cup 2022 is also coming to Keeneland. I want to thank Bill Finley. John Green's not here. We hope to see him back next week after he's done crying into his pillow about Paco. Alan Carrasso, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Jeffrey Russell, our producer, Patty Wolf, our editors, Danny Siper and Nathan Wilkinson, and our production coordinator, Michelle Sabrino. Thank you for watching. Wear a mask. We'll see you next week.